It is now time that we get to the lessons of St. Teresa Benedicta of the Cross. As we read the book, The Four Teresas by Gina Layer, we are on page 61.
Her lessons. Unlike Therese of Lisieux and Teresa of Avila, Edith didn't tend to share publicly the private workings of God in her soul. She wrote no extensive spiritual memoirs, and she referred to her conversion simply as my secret for me alone. Consistent with her philosophical inclinations, she usually spoke in abstract, objective terms, not in personal, subjective ones. So what we learn of her, we learn from the events of her life that we have just examined, taken together with her philosophical and devotional writings. Edith Stein's lived example has given us insight into loving Jesus with our whole mind. Through her lifelong journey, she came to trust in his wisdom instead of her own. In addition to living this love, in her writings, Edith addressed the idea of surrendering our mind to divine wisdom. She wrote specifically on three important themes. Number one, the unity of faith and reason. Number two, the wisdom of God. And number three, suffering and the cross.
The unity of faith and reason. The writings of St. Thomas Aquinas helped Edith discover the value of philosophy as a tool for discovering the mysteries of God within creation. With the guidance of the angelic doctor, Edith unified her identity as a philosopher with her identity as a believer. She realized she didn't need to reject intellectual or philosophical knowledge. Instead, she could put this knowledge at the service of truth. Her work from this time on was such that Pope John Paul II, in his encyclical Fides et Ratio, praised her for helping enrich the process of philosophical inquiry by taking faith into consideration. Her dialogue between Husserl and Aquinas, along with her finite and eternal being, helped earn Edith this distinction. Within their pages, Edith elaborates on the connection between philosophical knowledge and the truths of faith. In the dialogue between Aquinas and Husserl, Edith's ideas emerge through the mouthpiece of Aquinas, who dominates the conversation. According to St. Thomas, and now Edith, faith is a way to access truths that would otherwise be closed to us. Faith gives us more information. It doesn't eliminate any we already have. Edith believed that faith enriches our knowledge because it offers us something new over and above our natural experience. She realized that there are elements of truth that philosophy cannot grasp apart from the light of faith. Science and philosophy are valuable. They give us partial access to truth, but they stop short of the fullness of supernatural truth. Accepting what supersedes our natural understanding brings a deeper enlightenment. According to Edith, if philosophy honestly seeks the truth, it can't ignore the knowledge we access through faith, because all truth is interrelated. Edith further discusses this idea in her major work, Finite and Eternal Being. Here, Edith argues that the noblest task of a Christian philosopher is to prepare the way for supernatural truth. She believed that the perfect fulfillment of philosophy, which aims at wisdom, is the divine wisdom itself. In this same work, Edith explains that God may raise human beings above their natural ways of thinking to a totally different level of knowledge. This elevation, she believed, enables them to share in the divine vision that beholds all things in one simple glance. Faith expands the horizons of our knowledge, allowing us to be literally open-minded. Edith knew that many people can be closed-minded regarding matters of faith. Embracing the limited worldview that once held her captive, they accept only the truths of science and philosophy. This mentality leads some people to reject faith. Edith called this deliberate rejection of faith a state of blindness. She believed in the value of expanding her mind to include not only scientific analysis, but all of reality.
The wisdom of God. Edith Stein teaches us that the philosophical pursuit of truth finds its completion in the wisdom of God, and that loving God with the whole mind is not merely an intellectual process. Some may assume that for an intellectual such as herself, conversion came through discovering the seamless logical arguments in defense of the Christian faith, of which there are plenty. But as we have seen, it was the mysterious power of the cross, not an intellectual theory, that brought this philosopher to her knees. She had to move beyond her human understanding and humbly submit her mind to the wisdom of God. As St. Paul said when he preached about the cross, even the foolishness of God is wiser than human wisdom. See 1 Corinthians 1:25. So certainly the wisdom of God far exceeds our simple grasp. In the deeper forms of prayer, with which much of Carmelite spirituality is concerned, we open our minds to God's wisdom. Through prayer, Edith came into living contact with God. She experienced him in a more profound way than just hearing about him or learning about the things he had done. Coming to know God personally and allowed her mind to embrace a new kind of knowledge. In her essay, Ways to Know God, Edith compares natural knowledge of God to knowing about a person's existence because of things like photographs, writings, and other people's stories. But knowing God through supernatural experience, which comes through prayer, is like actually meeting a person. Personal knowledge allows the mind to grasp the deeper reality of who the person is, not reducing him or her to a collection of facts and reports. Faith, with the supernatural knowledge it gives us, is the bridge between natural knowledge of God and supernatural experience of him. As a Carmelite nun, Edith was well practiced in meeting God personally through contemplative prayer. In this form of prayer, the mind's normal activity is put at the service of loving God, who lifts the mind up to a supernatural plane. Contemplation offers insight that far surpasses anything we could arrive at by our own power. In such prayer, the mind can have a small share in the glory of divine knowledge. This knowledge is unending, infinite fullness at rest, as Edith put it. She believed that contemplation elevates the mind to share in heavenly knowledge. Hence, divine illumination can make a plain, uneducated person wiser than the most educated scholar. As Edith wrote, it depends on God to raise man above his natural mode of thinking to a quite different manner of knowing.
The different manner of knowing was a focus of Edith's great work, The Science of the Cross. Edith was fascinated with St. John of the Cross, whose writings were the inspiration for the work. He makes frequent reference to the dark knowledge of faith, because as our natural models of thinking surrender to God's wisdom, we experience a kind of darkness. This surrender can be frightening, because we do not yet know by experience what lies on the other side of our surrender. The knowledge that supersedes human understanding comes through a certain darkening of our natural thought processes. Accepting supernatural knowledge requires us to progress beyond the comfort of predictable axioms and formulas. But in return, we receive a new light, a light of faith, a light that dawns when the dark night has passed. Edith quotes St. John of the Cross, "For through the intellect you receive wisdom concerning one, two, or three truths. However, in the light of faith, the soul receives at once all of God's wisdom, that is, the Son of God, who communicates himself to her in faith. Jesus is the fullness of divine wisdom. Accepting him, submitting our whole heart, soul, and mind to him, allows the wisdom of God to guide us." Edith was quick to note, however, that accepting this wisdom also means accepting the cross.
Suffering and the cross. The folly of the cross, as St. Paul called it, see 1 Corinthians 1, 21-25, was essential to Edith Stein's conversion. Our ways are not God's ways, and our wisdom falls infinitely short of his. See Isaiah 55:8-9. The cross is the supreme sign of this. What appears to us to be the end, maybe only the beginning of God's almighty plan. The power of the cross overcame what seemed insurmountable, death. Through this unexpected power, Edith Stein first came to accept Jesus, and united to the suffering of the cross, she finally offered her life to him in martyrdom. Following her experience with Anna Reinach, Edith learned that the cross had the power to transform suffering into joy. She believed that helping Christ carry his cross fills us with peace and strength. Earthly logic cannot explain this truth. Rather, God reveals this to those who humbly accept his wisdom. Because of the significance of the cross in Edith's understanding of the faith, she wrote about it in a number of her religious essays, including Love of the Cross and exaltation of the cross. She did not fear suffering in union with Jesus, nor did she shy away from it. She understood that embracing it was a fundamental element of the Christian call. She urges us to remember this. The Savior today looks at us, solemnly probing us, and asks each one of us, "Will you remain faithful to the crucified?" Indeed, Christ instructed all those who follow him about the centrality of the cross. As Edith wrote, "We are to recall the challenge of the Lord. Anyone who would follow me must take up his cross." Having experienced suffering of many varieties in her life, the loss of her father as a young girl, the depression of her youth, the tragedy of war, the disapproval of her family, the discrimination of the Nazis, Edith was not naive. The radically unique Christian understanding of suffering inspired her. Instead of trying to explain suffering, ignore it, escape it, or rage against it, she found in the Christian faith a significance to suffering. It is a share in the redemptive power of Christ. In light of this vision, what may have appeared meaningless to Edith now had meaning. What might have seemed a waste now had infinite value. Faith offered her the choice to go beyond natural appearances, to accept a deeper wisdom about suffering. She came to understand that one might even choose to suffer, offering up some particular sacrifice as a prayer. As Edith wrote, such an action is not merely a pious reminder of the suffering of the Lord. Voluntary, expiatory suffering is what truly and really unites one to the Lord intimately. Submitting her mind to the deeper truths of the faith was not enough for Edith. She also wanted to submit her actions to the wisdom of God. Offering up sacrifices was a concrete way to demonstrate that she believed in something greater than human wisdom. But for all this suffering, Edith was not a gloomy saint. Rather, she took joy in the cross. She wrote,
"Because being one with Christ is our sanctity, and progressively becoming one with him our happiness on earth, the love of the cross in no way contradicts being a joyful child of God. To suffer and to be happy, although suffering, to have one's feet on the earth, to walk on the dirty and rough paths of this earth, and yet to be enthroned with Christ at the Father's right hand, to laugh and cry with the children of this world, and ceaselessly sing the praises of God with the choirs of angels, this is the life of the Christian until the morning of eternity breaks forth." These words capture the surprising nature of a faith that unapologetically embraces the paradox of the cross. This same faith proclaims confidently that God became a human, that a virgin gave birth, that bread and wine become the body and blood of Christ, that Jesus rose from the dead, and that eternal life is real. Edith Stein teaches us that fully living out our faith means joyfully submitting our mind to these supernatural mysteries.
Gina, one of the most amazing things that I'm gleaning from this book is you've really brought these saints to life. You've given them much more than just a person of history. You're really laying out how real and tangible their lives are and how relatable. To me, it now makes it so much easier to turn to them.
Woohoo! That's great, because that's my experience of the saints. And if that comes through for others, I think it's such a gift, because we have these companions. We have these intercessors. They're not just models. They're not just paintings. They're not just names in a litany. These are companions. These are spiritual companions to walk with us and to pray with us. You know, this is one of the things that was sort of new for me when I was going through the Ignatian spiritual exercises, was the idea of praying along with the saints and angels next to me and going to Jesus, like in the company of the saints and angels. Like we've got these companions to help us move forward in the life of prayer. And that ultimately is where we encounter Jesus as a person that we know, instead of as a collection of facts, right? Mary Beth, you're so right. We hear these stories, we hear these collections of facts, the Christmas stories or the Easter stories or the gospel stories. We hear them every Sunday. It can begin to just feel like a series of information. And that isn't enough to bring us into living contact with Jesus Christ. That comes through a life of prayer. So yeah, the saints are models of having done it, but they're also companions to journey with us, to help walk with us, to intercede for us. If you have a saint that you want to be like or pray like, ask them to pray for you, to have that kind of strength. And that's going to be a concrete assistance in moving in this direction, I think. So
During this Advent season, we're not supposed to be hustling around buying presents and doing all this secular stuff that distracts us. We are really supposed to be preparing our heart and our soul to receive Christ on Christmas Day. Does anybody have any concrete activities or things that you do with yourself or your family that helps you prepare spiritually for Christmas?
Well, I'll jump in here. So we kind of started this tradition. I have 5 children, and you know, now they're in ages range from 25 to 12, but probably about 6 or 7 years ago, as I was kind of involved in Bible study and just kind of really learning my faith. On Christmas morning, you know, we, you know, do the typical thing and open our gifts. I really started to propose there's a nursing home that was right around the corner, and that we would go there and actually sing Christmas carols. And so it kind of started into this little tradition with a couple other families. And I don't want to make it seem like, okay, yeah, we checked off the box. We feel good about ourselves because we did it on Christmas Day. But it is a starting point. And now my kids know to expect it. It's not like a big, you know, oh, I got to drag them there. And then the year of COVID, the people that we couldn't go into the nursing home. So we actually found parishioners that were older, that were cooped up in their houses and could not leave or go to mass at all. And we went around in the car and we with some other people from our parish and sang Christmas songs to them. So that was just an idea to start. There's like a lot of ways, especially
We have sort of a policy of a slow unveiling of Christmas decor. So that's just something I've used even to remind myself Advent isn't Christmas. So first week of Advent, that's when we're going to start playing Christmas songs, even though I know it's not Christmas and maybe we couldn't. But anyway, we don't start at Thanksgiving and we don't drink eggnog until December 1st or whenever Advent rolls in. Okay. Week one would be early Christmas decorations, stockings and the Advent wreath or whatever. Week two, maybe we'll get our tree and decorate that. Week three, the manger goes up, but not with baby Jesus in it yet. So we've just done some staggering. The particulars are so irrelevant. The point is just to find a way to remind yourself and your family that it's Advent. You're in a season of waiting. It's not all at once. So anyway, that's a strategy that we've used that also reduces the stress load for me, because it's not like it all has to happen at once. It's slowly unfolding over time. So it's practical too.
And one of the things that I do, I mean, I live alone, so, you know, my kids are grown, but now one of the things I really make imperative to do is when I do start taking out my Christmas decorations, the first thing I do is put up the manger scene, because I want to put that first and foremost in my head of what this is all about and why we're celebrating in this sense.
You know, Kathy, you bring up something super important about being alone through the holidays. Inviting someone that is alone to your home for a meal.
One thing that really stood out as we were reading this was the importance of embracing our cross. I feel like so much of our society and our world today, we're trying to run away from that cross. We're trying to get rid of it and make it go away.
This is the thing about human experience. We all have our various versions of suffering, and different religions make different proposals about how to handle it or what to do with it. And I think this is what was so compelling for Edith Stein, was that the Christian proposal is that suffering actually has meaning. It's not a question of escaping it. I mean, different, Eastern mystical traditions or whatever, more sort of like work yourself into a state where suffering can't touch you or you can't be affected, or realize that suffering is an illusion. The Christian proposal is so real. It's so gritty. It so resonates with our experience. Yes, everybody, even God himself incarnate in his family, was persecuted and sought after and suffered and died and, you know, all the whole nine yards all the way to the cross. But here we have a proposal that are embracing it, are accepting it, are recognizing that God's wisdom through this suffering is not wisdom that we can comprehend. There's a very captivating proposal there. It doesn't mean it's easy. It doesn't mean it doesn't involve a kind of surrender of your will and your comfort, but it's a captivating proposal that this actually has meaning, that it is not useless, that it is productive, and that there's purpose behind it. And I think at a deep level, the thing that's so bothersome about suffering is why? What is the purpose? And Christianity gives an offer for that, which is a lot of what Edith Stein has to say in her reflections on the science of the cross.
That's going to wrap up our readings for today. We'll see you again tomorrow on Living Witnesses as we read Gina Lair's book, The Four Traces.